order, we will hear from our committee administrator in terms of today's agenda, and if there are any issues where people have to sign up, please do that at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carter. On our agenda today, we have a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 267, public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 235, and then an informational meeting on 1999 regular session, plan for distribution of workers' comp funds. And so the first up on the agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 267, and we do have amendments with that as well.
Okay, these are the only people that signed up?
Yes.
If there are other people who are here to speak to Senate Bill 267, you need to sign up at this point. So we're going to have a little problem here. I hope I don't murder your name. Mr. Joel Ayo?
Ario.
And Charlie Nickliff? Please join us. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the administrator of the State Insurance Division. We're here today on some amendments to Senate Bill 267. It's a bill that's previously been in front of the committee, and so I won't go into the substance of the bill again unless there are questions. The amendments are pretty simple. The underlying bill requires some new documents to be developed by healthcare service contractors. These are documents that have previously been required of normal or regular health insurers. And what the amendments do is simply provide the same confidentiality protection to healthcare service contractors in reference to those documents as currently exist for regular insurers. So it's just a level playing field on these documents and the same kind of protection for everybody that generates the same kind of document.
If the committee will recall, there were about three questions that were of concern: the necessity of the bill, different types of insurance requirements, methods by which companies raise money for capital and surplus. Was that ever explained from the division? Did we receive any comments on that?
You may want to have them reiterate that. I don't know if that was, it wasn't explained after the.
Okay. Then I'd like for you to respond to these three questions. I'll give them one at a time. Necessity of the bill and reason for certain groups being required to have increases.
Okay, I'll give a brief answer, and if you want more detail, I'm going to ask Mr. Nikoloff to come up and join
me. Mr. Nikoloff, please join.
He's really our expert on it. The general reason for the bill is that the minimum capital and surplus requirements in Oregon have not been increased over the last decade or so, and as a consequence, our standards are now lower than most of other states, and when we look at it in terms of what it would actually cost to run a receivership, to liquidate a company, the surplus capital requirements, minimum capital requirements, just aren't adequate to the job, and so we wanted to increase them to have the money necessary to handle an insolvency if we face one, and then also to be kind of on a level playing field with other states.
Any questions? The next question was for discussion, different type of insurance requirements for businesses. And I think this question came up from one of the members of the committee in the sense that if an insurance company, depending upon their particular size, was about to go through the whole issue of solvency, does it matter the size of the insurance company in terms of the cost, or is there a general cost across the board?
There are some fixed costs and some that wouldn't be fixed, but I'll let Charlie give more detail.
Senator Carter, answer your question. Of course, no two insolvencies are alike, but it's been our experience that we've never had an insolvency yet that costs less than $500,000 to administer, because these things take on lives of their own. Our last one took 14 years to close because of reinsurance transactions and other state laws that had to be dealt with as well. But the whole purpose of the bill is to use the capital and surplus as a last resort for a liquidation. It also is a basis for how much risk an insurance company can take on. And as Joel mentioned, we haven't really had some of these increased in 25 years. So a dollar isn't what it used to be, so we're just trying to bring it current. And we're phasing it in over 5 years anyway.
Okay. And the third question was, what are the methods by which companies raise money for capital and surplus?
Senator Carter, it depends on the type of company. They can sell stock. They can borrow funds. If it's a mutual company, they're going to perhaps issue what's called a surplus note, which is a form of borrowing. It's left up to them, and there are no restrictions on how they can raise those funds. And if there's a problem, we can work with the company and extend these requirements if need be to grant them more time. So this depends on what they want to do.
Okay. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Charles Nikoloff, the Deputy Administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division.
Committee members, what I was just wondering if there are any, we do have some. Where do they come right now? We do have some amendments. That was, I think, did you suggest something that somebody came before you that spoke to this issue?
When we were here last time and explained the bill, we had realized that we had inadvertently left the need, or there was a need for these to begin with. We left them out.
Okay.
So these are just corrective, the way it should have been to begin with.
So this does not change the tenant of the bill itself?
No, it does not, and as far as I know, all the affected parties are aware of it, so there's no surprises here.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any opposition to this bill? I don't find any in my file.
Senator Carter, Senator Mazzarelli, as far as I know, no, there is not. There were some concerns addressed earlier. We've met with everyone who's wanted to talk about it, and as far as I know, everyone signed off.
Okay. Further question? What we're going to do until the chair gets here is that we're going to recess from the Senate bill, unless there's something else you want to tell us. We'll recess with Senate Bill 267 until it's okay. And we'll just recess it for a few minutes until he comes so we can go into work session and pass your amendments.
That's right.
Thank you. Senate Bill 267 and return at a time when the chair comes and go into a hearing on Senate Bill 235.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 235 authorizes certified nurse practitioners to sign death certificates. At the meeting on the 7th, the issues discussed were situations of when a death certificate must be signed, potential cost and time savings from the bill, and impact of the bill on signing of death certificates with assisted suicide. As some background, Oregon law requires that a physician sign a death certificate for each death that occurs in the state. And according to law, a doctor of osteopathy, chiropractic, or naturopathic medicine doctor can also sign a death certificate. Law does not permit, though, a certified nurse practitioner from signing. We did a public hearing and have some amendments to this bill as well, which are attached.
What's the nature of the amendments?
The amendments, and I don't think anybody from the health department is here, so Brian DeLashmet is one to describe.
Brian, thank you.
For the record, Brian DeLashmet, Oregon Nurses Association. What you have in front of you are the 235-1, or Health Division amendments. Dr. Grant Higginson was here last time. There was no controversy around the concept. It was clean. With the exception that they found a couple other statute citations that they thought needed to include nurse practitioners. It includes, as you can look through those, being able to release the body to a funeral director and having to have that signed and authorized and so forth. The one other change that you'll see on line 11, rather than just authorized to sign, is authorized to complete and sign a death certificate. That's another point that they made. But they don't just want a signed certificate. They want it completed and signed. So they wanted that language inserted. So we've looked at the amendments. They look fine to us.
Brian, just for the sake of people who might not remember, what does completed and signed mean?
Well, fill out the entire certificate, which could include, obviously, cause of death, time of death, so forth. So you had a nurse practitioner that was here that testified on this, and I've never seen, obviously, the process of filling one of those out, so I'm not sure I can fully answer your question.
Right. But, well, I have, but I just wanted to on the record, because even in hospice situations, nurse practitioners do fill that out in terms of the cause as well as the time.
Right.
And that is complete. It is considered a completed transaction, but I was just wondering if there was anything else associated with that.
Senator Carter, that's just leading in. And up to this point, up to until the passage of this, they actually could, in fact, fill out the information. They just couldn't sign the certificate. Someone else, a doctor, would have to do that, and this just changes that.
Somebody else, someone I don't recall who was here, said that we would probably have to change the statute in a sense that, or add something to it, because federal regulations or federal guidelines does not include now. It says a doctor instead of a nurse practitioner.
That was home health. That was a different bill.
Okay.
And that was Hirsch Crawford testifying about home health rather than.
Okay, I got them all mixed up here. Thank you very much. Any questions? And we have, is there anybody else to testify on Senate Bill 235-1 amendments? Well, all of you guys out there won't believe this, but our chair isn't here, and these are only two bills that we have up for today. We're just going to the informational hearing. We'll recess on this. Yes, Senator?
I don't see why we don't just have a work session on this and pass it. I mean, we're doing a thing on a death certificate. I mean, it's not like, you know, the person isn't dead if they don't have a signed death certificate or something. I mean, you know, like, what's...
I'm just
trying to be courteous to the chair.
I'm trying to be courteous to the chair, and they call it the party that is in power.
I know all about power. This guy's the chair of my real
party. I want him to continue to trust my ability to be his vice chair and not take over his job.
Do you think he's out of opposition?
This is a lesson. Do you think he's out of
opposition?
Okay, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll recess on the amendments to Senate Bill 235 and go into our informational hearing today for plans for distribution of funds. Is Doug here? Yes, please do always.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Carter. This is actually an informational hearing on a 1999 regular session bill that was passed. The Legislative Fiscal Office asked this committee to hear the plan regarding Senate Bill 288 from the 1990 regular session and to make comments, raise any concerns, generate any recommendations that will be sent in letter form to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, who will then act on this particular plan at that time.
And Doug, before you do that, we have a very special visitor here with us today. This young woman, I can't remember her name without seeing it right now. Julia is from Russia, and she is an exchange student at Wilson High School. And visiting us here at the legislature, she's interested in world politics and is visiting with us today. So welcome, Julia.
And
then we have, yes?
And Dmitry sitting beside her.
Dmitry is also from Russia.
No, from Belarus.
Oh, okay. It's nice to meet you. Sitting next to Julia is one of the students from the Portland Street Academy that is run by the Urban League of Portland, for which I am the president, Ezeal, and he's here today. Doug.
Mr. Chair or Madam Chair, it depends on how fast people sit. For the record, my name is Doug Wilson. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Finance and Policy Analysis here to provide a report as required by Senate Bill 288 of the 1999 session. As what committee staff stated, the purpose we're here is that sort of the request of Ways and Means for a policy committee review of this report. In the 1999 session, Senate Bill 288 repealed a provisional law that provided funding from the Workers' Comp Insurance Premium Refund Fund to various rehab or rehabilitation facilities across the state for their operation around workers' comp premiums and that sort of thing. It also transferred funds in a total of about a little over $8.9 million from the Workers' Benefit Fund to our department, the Department of Human Resources, now Services, for two purposes. to provide some phase-out period and to soften the impact, as well as to provide some time and resources to create a long-term solution. So for 9901, the reasoning was that we will distribute those funds as they were distributed in previous biennia, the half of the funds, approximately less than $4.5 million that went out to all the eligible rehab facilities that received funds in the past.
Mr. Chairman, just a question.
Yes, Senator.
Doug, and how did we do those rehab centers like Goodwill Industries? Were we able to resolve some of the issues around that one?
In terms of the refund amounts in the 9901 biennium, they were based on the three previous years of amounts. We were able to match some of that for those facilities that provide services to Medicaid-eligible recipients, which were the majority of the facilities and the majority of the clients in many of those facilities.
And probably it's just the issue was surrounding those privatized rehabilitation centers versus the public piece, well, the nonprofit piece.
Nonprofit.
The nonprofit piece, and so that was the issue. Thanks, Doug.
Senate Bill 288 also required our department, along with the LFO, Department of Administrative Services, and representatives of those rehab facilities to come together and work on a long-term solution. On the back of the handout that I provided to you is a list of the industry representatives to that task force. It was appointed based on both geographic region and size of the facility, so we had a good mixture of folks, both from the very small providers to the largers like Goodwill of Willamette, the Portland area, Columbia Willamette. So this group came forward, started taking a look at what needed to be done in the long term, and they came up with the plan, which starts on page 2 of the handout, which was basically to put together a self-insurance pool for these rehab services providers that designed to help them lower their workers' comp costs. And the self-insurance pool would be voluntary and open to all rehab service providers that wish to participate. And it would also expand, if you know, where possible, benefits to other types of rehab providers that met the requirements of that may have been beyond what was getting amounts through the workers' comp funds previously. Rehab service providers that choose to join the pool, self-insurance pool, would then determine the structure, the bylaws, and the principles that would govern that operating entity.
Question?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Doug, you're saying that the rehabilitation, whether they're profit or non-profit, they'll be able to bring in-house an insurance pool that when some of their workers were off, they would just take care of that time off as a result of any kind of debilitation that they might have. Please explain it to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, and I'm probably not the best. I do have someone here from the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Well, I won't take it to
explain this time. The concept of a self-insurance pool or a risk-sharing pool like this would be across a number of providers. That was the anticipated use of the funds. But the group decided to do was put aside $1.1 million to help establish this pool, both as a stabilization fund or the reserve fund that is required by DCBS and state statute around self-insurance and also to help with startup costs. That $1.1 million represents about 25% of the remaining funds for distribution this biennium. They looked at two options for financing. The first one was to look for general fund for that $1.1 million. But unfortunately, the governor's budget and the constraints that he had in putting together a budget, that $1.1 was not available. So the second option was to take the 25% of the approximately $4.5 million remaining for distribution and use that up for the startup cost and the reserve funds for the self-insurance pool. The other remaining three quarters of that 4.5 would be distributed to those rehab facilities as they were in the current biennium, proportionally.
So what's going to be the effective option, too, on those rehab facilities? I mean, can they deal with this reduction, this change from 4.5 to 3.4 or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, this was the decision of the planning committee that had representatives of the facilities on it. They would rather have, I'm sure, the $1.1 million from the general fund, but that's not available in the governor's budget. So that is why they had set out a separate option to use three-quarter of the remaining funds.
Okay, and a follow-up?
Yes.
Doug, if I understand it right, you buy your way into the pool and you get cheaper workers' comp rates, right?
For many of the providers, Senator Shields, that would be the case.
Okay, if you don't buy it, you'd get higher workers' comp rates. Where's the point where it breaks even? I mean, you know, some would buy in because the 1.1 represents an outflow. The lower workers' comp rates would represent an inflow. Are they all trying to figure out where the break-even point is and whether they should be in or out on financial basis? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I believe that would be the case. They would have to take a look at each individual case because the risk pool is, or the self-insurance is, a voluntary. Many will probably wish to participate because it makes financial sense. Some may find that it does not pay to participate. But the group, which included both the large and smaller providers across the spectrum, did agree that 25% should go for the startup costs and reserve funds of this pool.
One more follow-up,
Senator.
And so the group feels that probably at least a critical mass of them will go for this plan. They've looked at it close enough to know that you'll have critical mass.
That is my understanding. I think it'd probably be a better question, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, to ask someone from the industry. And I, like I said before, I'm definitely not an expert in self-insurance pools or what criteria financially they look at.
Having had some experience with group insurance policies and seeing that generally always there's a real cry from those that haven't either done a good job of monitoring their insurance or use their ability to buy as reasonably as they can one thing and another, they always a hue and cry for them to go in on the backs of the others that have done well. And there's a rather great reluctance for the ones that have done well to sit still for this kind of a situation. And it's not worked out very well in several organizations I've been with to try to offer a group situation just because of that. And my wondering is just how thinly this can be utilized and how many of the ones that have the high costs that are looking for reduced rates can go in and afford to maintain that type of a situation of self-insurance when the ones that only stand to lose don't see fit to join. So what kind of a ratio do you have to have? You get along on a 25% of the group doing it?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert in that area. I think maybe the representative from DCBS could help out with that if you wish to.
He's forward, certainly welcome to come up.
Yeah, Doug, three strikes you out. You're right to make him come up.
Well, I try to cover, but I learned, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, when to quit.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Manahan. I'm the acting manager of the compliance section of the Workers' Compensation Division for DCBS. We do certify groups who apply for certification under self-insurance. The actual cost from the discussions you've had is accurate. It is a risk assessment for each group that comes in under an application. On a group, we do have minimum standards. We require surety bonds or surety deposits of some form or fashion that would secure any liabilities that would be encountered by the group. We require excess insurance to cover catastrophic types of losses. We also require joint and several liability amongst the members of the group, which means that if there are losses, all members of the group would be financially liable for those costs as being members of the group. So there is some risk associated with self-insurance. So those are decisions that each of the members of the administrators would have to consider.
I don't see, and maybe I just haven't had a chance to really peruse this yet, I don't see exactly how much the savings would be in relationship to the amount having to be put up and so forth and the amount they're paying now. I know several times because of the consequences, I've chosen to pay a little more for something, knowing that that limited my liabilities, rather than to pay a little less and not to be able to sleep at night for fear that something that I couldn't control was going to come along and do me in. And so how much really self-insuring do they have a potential of saving? Let's say that everything all being equal and they all went into it and they put up this $1.1 million, and how much would they save over what they're paying now?
Mr. Chair, a lot of that would depend upon their loss experience. If they have low or no losses, they could have a significant savings because their costs are going to be in direct proportion to the amount of their losses, the claims costs that result from those losses, and any cost to administer the claims that would result from those losses. So if they keep their losses low, there's a potential for savings for the group. If they have, like I say, a high incident of losses and expensive losses, it could be greater cost to the members.
But if they kept their losses low, they're going to have lesser costs anyway. And then my guess is that they haven't kept their costs low, and they're looking for a way to get around it. Now, what's to ensure that they're going to change their ways just because they're part of a group? There's a lot more incentive if you're out there alone and you have a chance to save something and it's dependent on your action. There's a real push to go ahead and save. If you're tagging along on somebody else's good works, there's not near the, generally speaking, there's not nearly the pressure to maintain your watch over things. And that's been an area that we've had some problems with. And people are really reluctant when they've taken the time themselves to have a good record to go in and then sit there and maybe be shot down by some people that are coming in and tagging on their coattails. And that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out. If just say they go into this, all things being equally, what do they save if nobody does any better than what they're doing now?
Mr. Chair, I probably couldn't give you an exact cost type of figure of savings because of the various types of insurance plans that are also out there for groups. I could try to work up some figures to try to give in some estimates if you and the committee would wish.
Senator Shield.
Mr. Chair, there's a gentleman here by the name of Tim Crawl from the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. I'd be interested in hearing his perspective as one of the groups that's been participating in it. I think he would address some of your questions as well as some of the questions I asked.
I don't have a problem with that. I apologize. I had some personal things I had to take care of. A family member having surgery and stuff, and I had to make a couple phone calls, and I got here late. But I didn't hear the exact background of what our way we're proposing to start here, whether you were the first on the list to testify on this issue, and we're going down the line of a list. I don't see a list here normally that we would have for people to testify. And so, and looking at an informational meeting status here, I don't know exactly what staff had planned.
They were here all together.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's up to you.
Why don't I go ahead and let Doug finish up what he's got in the way of his presentation, and if Tim could stick around for a few minutes after that, then we could certainly give him an opportunity to speak.
Mr. Chair, and I'm almost done, let me remind the members of the committee that this is a voluntary decision whether they want to participate or not. In fact, I think part of this industry also already has such an entity for many of them. Keep in mind that these are funds that have flowed to them for a number of years. It was a decision of this legislature and the governor not to continue that past this next biennium. And we were looking for a long-term solution to make up the difference of these lost funds, or at least help them transition to something. If for some reason a pool is not put together and the $1.1 million is not required for the reserve fund or the startup costs, over time, the remaining $1.1 million would then be distributed to these providers on the same way that the other three quarters of it would be. So if they were not able to put a pool together for some reason or meet the criteria of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, that those funds would still flow to those rehab providers. And with that, I think that pretty much finishes up my part of that report, and urge your letter to the Ways and Means. The expenditure limitation for these funds are in our budget. There, $4.9 million will be transferred from DCBS, from the Workers' Comp Fund, to our department at the end of this biennium for use next biennium for this purpose.
Tim, would you want to come up and add anything that you might wish to add to this? And is there anyone else that wishes to, Doug, did you have anyone else in the group that?
No, unless you have specific questions.
Okay, well, if we raise something, and I don't always know what's going to spring from the active brains of my colleagues here, or even my own sometimes, but if you have folks here, don't hesitate to mention that as this thing goes on, because we'll take time to hear them. Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Tim Krall, and I'm director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We represent nonprofit community providers of services to people with disabilities. Senator Fisher, the issues you raise about insurance groups are very valid. We've had a workers' comp group since 1994, and we've gone through some cycles. It hasn't been a self-insured group. It was more like a group retro. And the issues you bring up about the weak, sick people wanting to stay and the good people getting better rates elsewhere actually did happen to us. But it was not a self-insured corporation. And the attraction of the self-insured that we see is that you set your own entry and exit criteria. So there are criteria for getting in. If the loss ratio is too high, you couldn't get in. If your loss ratio gets worse, you get put on probation and you exit. We've drawn up bylaws that have specific entry and exit criteria, probation criteria, and you share in the profits differently as well. If your loss ratio exceeds 50%, your sharing of the profits goes way down, so your incentive in a self-insured is much greater to perform. I mean, the issues you addressed are true of groups unless you really control it. We've looked at the city and county and the Special Districts Association who have self-insured. The law was changed in the late 80s to allow them to self-insure. Looked at their plans. We've met with Marsh McClellan, who administers their plans. We've had our own members participate in those meetings, and they believe we could conservatively save 10%. That's not a lot. You're talking about a hit, an overall premium of everybody played, which they never will, of maybe $7 million. But that's, you know, if you get, we figure you need $1 million to $1.5 million minimum to make the frictional costs worthwhile, low enough to make the plan work. And we definitely have that much interest and more. So if you're saving a couple $100,000 a year on a $2 million base over time, that is a savings. These numbers just show the kind of costs we're faced with and what we get hit with. The other advantage on page 2, we currently have to pay people who earn less than minimum wage on an assumed hourly wage of $5.15, no matter what they really earn. The average productivity in workshops is about 30%. So we're paying them $2.10 an hour, but we're paying comp on $5.15 an hour, which really means our workers' comp total is about 10%. That's what the law was originally set up to do, was to give us a break. That's why we got the refund. So taking that away is a hit to us. If we have a self-insurance company, we can set that rate ourselves. We don't have to have a rate imposed of this assumed hourly rate for people with disabilities.
How do they figure that consumed, current assumed hourly wage?
That's what workers' comp sets, and they set it for volunteer workers. They set it for people earning less than minimum wage. They set it for educational folks. If you get hurt and you're not getting a standard wage, they want to make sure there's enough of a premium to cover your injuries. On if you get hurt as a volunteer, if you get hurt as a injured worker, the doctor doesn't discount his services because you were a volunteer or because you were working at sub-minimum wage. So they give you, workers' comp, DCBS gives us an assumed hourly that we have to pay on. If we self-insure, we set that ourselves based on our risk. And you also talked about what happens, what kind of security. We have stop loss for individual claims, have aggregate stop loss. That's a part of the package. So we would only insure up to limits that we think we can afford, and then we would sell off, buy reinsurance for the rest of those, the rest of that exposure. It's self-insurance kind of up to a point, and then we would buy reinsurance because we couldn't carry the full exposure either.
Why are you paying workers' comp on volunteers?
Because in some instances it's required, and I'm not sure specifically which. I just know when I called them and said, what do we pay on people with sub-minimum wage, they said $515, and that applies to a whole bunch of categories, and they included volunteers. But that's kind of beside this point. That's a category they use. So
that kind of defeats the purpose of a volunteer, doesn't it?
If you want to have a volunteer who's covered by comp and you want them on your work site, I guess that's what their plan is. I don't know.
Don't recall ever having any type of compensation in that form to any volunteers in private business.
Yeah, you're asking me about, I don't know. I just know that when I talked to them, they said this covers volunteers too, but I'm really interested in the sub-minimum wage part. And we do get nailed there just because of that difference. And with our own company, we would set that rate. So all the issues you raised about what potentially is scary about a group are very real, and we've experienced them. We believe, and taking $1 million away, I mean, in essence, if you don't give us an extra million, which I doubt you will, taking $1 million away from ourselves is a difficult decision. But the members felt long-term, this was our best shot at reducing cost. In the same, every city, county, special districts, they all do very well by self-insuring. Large industries over $2 million a year, almost all self-insure. Because you're right, the incentive, as you pointed out, to save your own money. The only way you do that with a group is to kick people out who aren't keeping their losses down. And that's what these guys would own the company. I mean, they would be the owners. So there's no incentive for them to carry anybody.
I guess I'm just having a hard time seeing how a program here that where I would say that already you're starting with a couple of strikes against you if you're going to start doing this kind of thing for volunteers and everything, and you're utilizing a lot of people.
I may be wrong about the volunteer.
That are below, well, you got average prevailing wage, average hourly wage. You got $210 an hour.
Yeah, if you're working at 30% and
does a person working at $210 an hour have any less injury exposure over an 8-hour period of time than somebody that works for $10, $12, $15 an hour? I mean, that's,
good question,
how
Senator.
How can you beat the $515?
Because they don't have the same exposure because they're supervised so closely that. Actually, the injury rate for people with disabilities is quite low. The injury rate for our staff is pretty much industry standard. That's, you know, but the injury rate for people with disabilities, because of the supervision level, they don't get placed in the same kinds of positions where you're more likely to be injured as employees without disabilities do. So their injury rate is much lower. We don't have the exposure with them, and we object to paying this assumed rate. It just costs us money. We don't have the experience. We've looked at who gets hurt, what they get hurt doing. I mean, we've generated all the records, talked to SAFE, had them run the records. It isn't the people with disabilities that cause our losses. So we feel here we're overpaying for that population. And with our own company, we would set that rate lower and save that money.
Yeah. Okay. Looked like you might have some work that you need to do with some of your full-time work.
In the sense of reducing, in our group, our loss ratio went from above 50% on average to in the high 30s. We reduced it about 14%, which is good. It's not good enough, but in the human service industry, you end up with so many back claims from moving people. It's just a constant process.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, I know you know, Senator. It is a never-ending
process. Years ago, when I was doing the active operation of my business, I had a 2% loss ratio.
And we have a few people. That's marvelous. That's very impressive. We'd be happy with a 30.
I guess I had an incentive to stay in business. I didn't have anybody to keep me in business. And so you don't just get happy with anything. You're looking all the time for some way that you can make a go of it. And if you can find a place to save on paying insurance, that's one place that you can put it right back in the payroll pocket of the people that you're hiring.
Right.
I was much sooner to do that than pay it out to insurance.
We agree.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hsu.
As I understand Doug Wilson, what's being asked of us is a letter to Ways and Means.
The sub Ways and Means would just like your input, comments, questions, or concerns about the plan, as brief or as long as necessary. They'll ultimately make a decision on action, a decision on this plan.
I think I'm going to give you the assignment that I give pretty standard to people that come to me with something that I'm not nearly as familiar as they are. And I ask them to draft a letter saying what they want to say. I give them every opportunity to sing their song. I look it over very carefully and see whether I agree with it. And that way I know that I'm using the right terminology, I'm addressing the right issues and making a meaningful letter. If I disagree with them and there's something, then I contact them. We try to work those things out. And so I guess I would give you that assignment to draft a letter in the direction that you want to go, putting the things that you have down there so that there's no mistake and we don't give a direction that is not what is exactly your intentions. And then having a chance for my committee to look that over and work with you on that and go from there. Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, that's fine. I'll work with your staff on that.
All right.
And Mr. Chair, that'll be a letter that all of us will see and discuss here?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
I think that's the only route, because I do not wish to make final decisions for my committee.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the informational meeting on the distribution of funds from Senate Bill 288 in the 1999 regular session, and I thank those that have come here to help us out with that issue. Guess I'm still playing catch-up ball here, but we're going to go back to a work session on Senate Bill 267. I'll open that work session. I understand we have some amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Shields.
I'd move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 267.
Senator Shields adopts the Dash 1 amendments, moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 267. Is there further comment or discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator
I'm sorry we weren't here. Looks like all we're doing is adding the health care service contractor, that section. Is that what the minutes to do? Okay. Page 15.
I believe that to be the case.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Hearing no objection, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 267 to the floor with the due, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves Senate Bill 267 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Rizzoli?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Shields, would you like to carry that one?
Sure.
All right. Senator Shields will be the carrier, and the motion passes. Close the work session on Senate Bill 267 and open a work session on Senate Bill 235.
Mr. Chairman.
We have amendments here also, from what I understand. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Move the amendments to Senate Bill 235-1.
All right. Senator Carter moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 235. Is there further discussion or objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Move 235-1 to the floor with due pass recognition.
Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 235 with the dash one amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Mazzoli.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator
Carter. Aye.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Mr. Chair. Aye. Motion carries. If you have a volunteer carrier for Senate Bill 235, you'll do that, Senator Carter?
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much. Senator Carter will carry it, and the motion carries. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 235. And is there anything else to come before the committee? We have no meeting Friday because it's been a called as a in-district day, which I guess everybody will be, most everybody will be in probably Senator George's district.
No, it's over the...
Oh, it's Senator Duke's district. All right. But have a nice weekend.
Oh, that's right.
A good day, and we'll not have any committee on Friday.
You guys invite me to Dorchester?
You want to go to Dorchester? Well, if you wear this, you look great.